Good morning. Good morning. Happy Sunday. My name is Lama. In a few minutes, Venerable Bina will be entering to give the teachings. If you've never been here before, if you please stand out of respect for her and the teachings. We'll be saying some prayers in the White Prayer Book, the first base sheet and the second sheet, which is pink in color. If you have cell phones, would you please mute them or so that it doesn't disturb the teachings. If Venerable Robina opens the floor for questions, comments, and so forth, would you please wait and speak through the mic, because people will be watching, and people who, you know, aren't able to come or live long distances away, and then if they miss the question, then it sort of, you know, they lose some of the participation in our teaching. They won't know what Venerable Robina is talking about when she answers the question. So it'd be very helpful if you did that, if she does ask for questions at the end. Last Sunday, Venerable Robina changed her, the topic was still the same, but she sort of changed the way she approached the teaching. So it's, it would, so if you wanted to stay in the second one, it would be a little bit different. So now Geshe-la usually repeats the same session, so it would be, you know, sort of, it's not necessary to stay for the second session. But Venerable Robina just changes it a little bit. So you'd be welcome to do that. And then afterwards, there's going to be a Guru Puja, and that's why there's, you know, different, more flowers and more their offerings and so forth. The setup on the altar is different. And that starts at 1 o'clock, and you're welcome to either come back for that or stay through that time. Let's see. Geshe-la has requested that I invite people to walk around the stupa clockwise. It's an amazing merit. And also to turn the prayer wheels clockwise, you know, toward the left. It's a very great purification practice, and is a great accumulation of merit if you do that. It's amazing merit. So we welcome people to do that. So we can just sit and get our minds ready for the teachings. In case I don't have a chance, I'd like to mention our sponsors for today, for Sunday. Ken and Annie Hassel. And I guess they didn't have a specific dedication. Anonymous donor. May all teachers of pure Dharma have long lives. May all caregivers of people with Alzheimer's find peace and comfort. And also Paul Hagwood, who sponsored the entire visit, so, and all the events. So we thank our sponsors. And also, sometimes Venerable Robina goes over time, so I'd like to go ahead and say the prayer list, and you can say your prayers or meditate while I do this. Prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. All the Tibetans who have been killed or taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Venerable Damcho Pelge, Frank Lake. Mary Elizabeth Balcom, Joe Bertha, Gwen Bowen, Deirdre Frank, Mary Beth Park, Jaden Sharp, Kami Tsering, Lumina the Fish, Pokey the Dog. Job Search. John Pell, Justin Kelly, Roseanne Barona, James Lillig, Sarai. Prayers for Health and Well-Being. Kabje Lama Zopa Rinpoche, Venerable Margaret McAndrew, Venerable Chirki Lama, Venerable Losang Tsering. All those harmed by natural and man-made disasters. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Jim Barnes, Roseanne Barona, Marcy Belle Isle, Carolyn Burns, Helen C., Lilo Cardarelli, Beth Cruz, Walker Doherty, Dimitri Diamandopoulos, Richard First, Sean McGarity and Family, Jasmine Gesnell, Mildred Gooch, Margaret Gullimond and her daughter, Nikki and Family, Pema Hart, Francis Hayashi, Leslie and Joan Inman, Jenny Jackson and Buddy, Richard Cable, Helen Kessenoff, Katie, Shanti and Kurt Vettermer, Jen Lee and her father, R.M., Mark, Bella, and Hazel, Tom McGinnity, Sarah Miller, Patrick Nagatani, Jeff Niblett, Jay Pontia, Pierre Parento, Lindsay Piatti, Aunt Polly, Brent Richardson, Eileen Rubin and family, Dr. Albert Sontz, David Schenk, Rosemary Cease, Jaden Sharp's mother, Andre Smith, Michael Smith, The Will Foundation, Lopsan Tugden, Dion Washington, Dorothy Wurtis, Dorothy and Cadre the Pigs.
Good morning. So we expect Venerable Urbina to arrive any minute, but while we're waiting, I wanted to make an advertisement for her. We have for sale in the bookstore DVDs of her biography, Chasing Buddha, which is about especially her work in prisons and her life story that was filmed by her nephew, Emile Corton, about 10 years ago, and then it's just been re-released with extra features on it, like updates of some of the prisoners who are featured in the film. So benefits from the sale of that CD go to the Bodhicitta Trust, which benefits FPMT projects, and some of the proceeds from sales here benefit Kadampa Center, so the money goes to good places. And she's also leading a pilgrimage in October and November of this year to the holy sites of India and Nepal. And I've been on the pilgrimage. Many people actually from Kadampa Center have been on it one year or another and can tell you about what a phenomenal, life-changing, fun, crazy experience it is to spend about 4 weeks. The first week is typically at Kopan Monastery, which is the monastery that was founded by Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who founded our whole FPMT group. And then you spend about 3 weeks touring through Nepal and into northern India, where the major sites of the Buddha, where he was born and taught major texts and everything. So it's really amazing. If you're interested in that, there are postcards for it in the lobby. And I'd be happy to tell you about it. So would Donna Cease, and we can point you towards other people, too.
Good morning.
Thank you.
So before we start, just so tell me the prayers we're doing again. Just say the prayers we're doing.
Which prayers?
Everything, what we're doing here.
The Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, then the Four Immeasurables in English and Tibetan, and then Chenrezig Six mantra and Tara.
Okay. So basically just what we're doing, this is the first one, as you know, it's this mantra, Sanskrit syllables, basically. Yeah, Sanskrit syllables, which is name, words. And words represent thoughts, and thoughts for the Buddha are everything. And so even just thinking things is practice, you know. Just thinking things, contemplating things, thinking about compassion. So these things, saying the the words in Sanskrit, we might know the language Sanskrit, but if we know what it represents, this enlightened energy, one is just the classic Buddha, Mr. Buddha, the monk of 2,500 years ago, and the other two, Chenrezig is a manifestation or a representation of compassion, and the other one, Tara, is a representation of action, cutting through the obstacles, fearlessness, you know. We need all these qualities, and so the whole idea here is these prayers, these mantras, by saying these words, we're kind of connecting with that. You're reminding yourself of that. You're putting the imprint into your mind of what that represents, which kind of makes sense. You know, when you think things, this is what turns you into the person you become. So in that sense, there's meaning to it, you know. There's meaning to it. And connecting us to it, and of course in the Buddha's view, connecting us with that potential in ourselves, helping us develop that very potential for perfection, for goodness, for compassion, for, you know, for success, for fearlessness, for courage in dealing with the troubles of daily life, you know. And then of course there's a little prayer called the Four Immeasurable Thoughts. Such powerful thoughts. This wish, a lot of the prayers in Buddhism, they're like, may this, may that. It's putting that too, that imprint, that thought in your mind. May all beings be happy. May beings be free of suffering. It's a marvelous series of simple little thoughts. So, let's have these thoughts.
Can Shakyamuni's Buddha's mantra 3 times? Taya ta
mune mune maha munaya soha taya ta mune mune maha munaya soha Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Munaya Soha.
May all sentient beings have happiness
and
the causes
of happiness.
May all sentient
beings
be
free
from suffering
and
the
causes
of suffering.
May all sentient
beings
be
inseparable
from the happiness
that is free
from
suffering.
May all sentient
beings
abide in
equanimity,
free
from
attachment
for friends and hatred
for enemies.
Sentientam Chedevadam of the pink page, you see Chenrei 6 mantra, we'll say that 8 times, and right above that, green Taurus mantra, 7 times. Om Mani Padme Hum,
Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum.
Okay. Well, you know, there are so many ways we can bring things into our lives, say, from Buddhism or any spiritual, you know, any spiritual path, way of seeing things, or even if you're not called spiritual. And basically, the basic idea is in all of them, isn't it? Like I say, you know, you'd be a good communist, a good Catholic, you know, a good Buddhist, and a good Muslim. If they didn't open their mouths, you wouldn't tell the difference. If they didn't speak their philosophy, you wouldn't know the difference. You know, they'd all be just nice people who'd be kind to others and be polite and apologize and try not to harm. That's what a good human being is, and that's something so fundamental. And it seems to me if any spiritual path or philosophical approach to life is a valid one, it has to be doing that, you know. It has to be this. Otherwise, how can it be valid? To anything that harms sentient beings, it just can't be valid, you know. Just can't be. And that's, I mean, the fundamental point, certainly the Buddhist one, it's very clear in the Buddhist one, you know, because Buddha's not a creator and doesn't assert a creator, which is often what we even think spiritual means, then the usual view of what morality is, and this is nothing wrong, if I, you know, when I had faith as a Catholic in God, by definition, a sin was something that God said you shouldn't do. That's what made it wrong. Because God said to do it and I didn't do it, that's what made it wrong. I remember talking to a Catholic priest. He said there is something about the natural law. You know, it's not good to kill. But he said the main point was is because God said so. And that's a big point. Well, that's not the point. And that's often how we think in our house, too. When Mummy says don't do this, we think we're naughty because Mummy said. And that's the usual view we have. But the Buddhist view is morality is something really provable, fundamental. And it's, if you look at other sentient beings, dogs or humans, animals, creatures, anyone, you can see they don't like it. They don't like suffering. They don't like being harmed. It's pretty straightforward, you know. Check yourself, you don't like being harmed. So that's what morality is. That's how Buddha would define it. And so the fundamental starting, one instruction, one piece of advice, you want to take it away. Which everything flows from this, certainly in the Buddhist tradition. Don't harm others. Bottom line, you see a living being, try not to harm them. We're going to harm all the time, but we don't realize we harm. We don't mean to harm. But the bottom line is, if you see a living being, try not to harm them. And this, for the Buddhist, means the ants, the lice, the rats, the cockroaches, the lot. Which is a tough, of course, because we're not used to that. So, how to bring this into your daily life, if you think it this way, you know, it just... What helps, I think, because we're creatures of habit, aren't we? We like to have, we sometimes feel better when the structure and form in our lives. Okay, some of us can be really fanatic about that, be obsessive. But we can also see the other way when you've got chaos. If your house is completely confusing, if you never know where the toilet is and you just go to the toilet wherever you feel like it, never know where the kitchen is and cook here in the bedroom one day and sleep in the kitchen the next day, you get crazy after a while. So it's nice to have structure, you know, a room where you go to sleep, a room where you go to the toilet, a room where you eat your dinner, and times to do these things. The whole world works in this way. The nature seems to work in this way, you know. So it helps us to have structure, especially when we see that we're so chaotic in our poor heads. We go up and down like yo-yos and so much emotion and unhappiness and unexpected things happen and the hubby and I have a fight and the kid was mean and boss sacks you. Unexpected things happen all the time. So to have a structure to go back to is really helpful, you know. So a simple way to have a so-called daily practice is to do something in the morning and something at night. I just think of it as two bookends that, you know, put sort of beginning and the end of my day. And to try and keep it as a discipline. And of course, we all know this is the hardest part. We're not very disciplined. Well, we're not disciplined at things we don't want to do. We're very disciplined at having our sleep, usually. We're very disciplined at having our breakfast and our lunch or whatever it is, you know. So one of our biggest mistakes, you know, it's called laziness. It sounds a bit funny. Actually, recently there was an Australian television channel, you know, they have these religious programs and sometimes they ask you to join in their program, you know. So there's one, they're having a thing on what they call them, the seven deadly sins. And they're these really old-fashioned medieval phrases like wrath and sloth. Who uses the word sloth? We don't use that word anymore. Well, a better word for it is called laziness, you know. And she wanted me to do the wrath day or the craving. What do they call it? What do they call the seven deadly sins? What's attachment called? Lust. Lust, wrath, sloth. Sounds so intense, doesn't it? So anyway, they're having, you know, people just to talk about the books, of their favourite books or their on this topic. And so she wanted me to do the wrath or the lust, because sloth sounds weird, you know. And so I couldn't fit those days. I said, I can do the sloth one. I said, that's a really good one for Buddhists. And she was quite surprised. So what is that one? I was curious. Well, you know, a better word is laziness. And we all kind of know it's laziness, but we don't tend to think that as a sin, you know. Oh, I'm tired. What do you mean it's lazy? I'm tired. I need to sleep. But let's look at that. It's kind of interesting. This is the one that prevents us from having our structure, from improving in what we do, from developing some, from achieving our wishes, and even forget about your spiritual path in your own ordinary daily life. You know, it's this kind of laziness, and it's surprising if we look at the different levels of it, the way they talk in Buddhist psychology. It's very surprising to us. The first one's obvious. It's the laziness that says, can't be bothered. And that's the sloth one. And of course, you can see it in a very gross way. If you just can't be bothered doing anything, and the house is a mess, and you don't take care of your jobs, and that's a really deep one. And we can see these days that's an indication of real depression, perhaps. But it's this awful inertia that we have, you know. And this is the one that is straight, the deepest obvious obstacle to achieving anything. So if, let's say, we decide we want to achieve something in our spiritual life, forget about achieving tennis or a job. But you can see it's the same in all. But here we're talking in terms of a spiritual practice. You've got to make effort. Because the opposite to lazy is to make effort. And can't be bothered means you don't want to make effort. And it sounds so simple. But it's got real profound meaning if we look into it a bit deeply. And we can see it's our worst problem, you know. One of our worst, it stops us from achieving anything. So in the Buddhist tradition, in the more advanced stages of practice, in the Bodhisattva path, the compassion wing of the teachings, they talk about the various developed practices. And one of them is this practice, they call it, of developing enthusiasm or perseverance or joyful effort, they call it. Joyful effort. Making joyful effort. I mean, it sounds so weird. Joyful effort. It seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? Effort's hard work. But joyful effort. Give me a break. But this is the point. If we think of ordinary life, and you think of ordinary things that ordinary people achieve, not talking spiritual, we can see to achieve anything, you have to make effort. You have to make effort. And that's what learning is. That's what learning is. Learning something means learning something you don't know already, and that means making effort. There's this point where you've got to struggle to learn to spell, learn to write, learn to ride the bike. Ordinary things at every stage of our life. We can see our ability to progress further mentally, spiritually, physically. You've got to push past that barrier where it says, oh no, I can't be bothered, which means it's too much effort. It's a really huge one, actually, and it's the main obstacle. It's obvious. If the goal is to, even, again, talking ordinary life, not spiritual, if the goal is to just, to study a course, you've got to make effort. You've got to sit there, do your homework every day, memorize it, write your essays, whatever it is. It really takes effort. And the reason it takes effort is because the status quo is you don't know that information. So you've got to push yourself. And that's really what laziness is. And we shouldn't put ourselves down for it, but we've got to see it for what it is. And this is the first level, the most obvious. So if we take our spiritual practice one, you know, even you make a decision, you get all excited, you go and do a retreat, you get all excited and all optimistic and inspired, I'm going to do a daily practice, you know. We feel we want to do this because it's a good indication for us. Because you've done your practice every day, you've done this every day, and you can look at this, whether you're going on a diet, whether you want to go to the gym, you know, your New Year's resolutions. You feel good when you've done it, when you've kept your own word to yourself. You've made the effort. And we know we get optimism from this. It's very helpful to us. It's very skillful. So, you've decided, I'm going to do a morning practice, you know. So you get up the first morning, all eager beaver, and you do your little things, and you sit down, you do your practice, you feel good. Then you go to work. Then the next day, same thing. But, you know, by the third day, maybe you wake up, oh no, you know. Isn't it? So the gross one of laziness is, can't be bothered. Or we wouldn't say that so directly, it seems too cruel to ourselves. We'd say, oh, I'm too tired. And then we'd start to sort of rationalize it, to make ourselves, because we feel guilty. So we say, well, it's all right, Rebecca, I'm too tired, I need to sleep, I've got to work, and then we go back to sleep. That's the obvious one, the first one. But then the second kind of laziness, which is more tricky, which does not sound like laziness. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds really valid. And we spend our lives doing this one. And it's a lie. We say, oh, I'm too busy, I'll do it later. That's called procrastination. And that is the worst. It's not the worst yet. There's a third one, even more subtle, even more profound, even the biggest obstacle to our achieving anything. But this is the commonest one we have. And because our lives are so busy, because we have so many balls in the air, so many responsibilities, the way the world is these days, everything's so frantic. And we do have a lot to do. But this one means we have to, you know, we know if we think of it carefully, We have to prioritize. We have to prioritize, you know? And we don't prioritize. We just say, we say it and we believe it. Excuse me. We believe our own propaganda. Because the thing that you're going to say, I'm too busy to do, I'll do it later, is what? The thing that takes too much effort. So we're being honest to ourselves, which we ought to be, otherwise we'll never stop, we'll never see the problem. We'll say, we should say to ourselves, oh God, I can't be bothered doing that, I'll try and do it later. But when we feel guilty, we know we can't be bothered, we then say I'm too busy, we immediately think of things we ought to do instead, they seem more important, and then we sort of bolster ourselves and stop ourselves from feeling guilty by saying, I'm too busy, I've got to do this first, I've got to get to work, I've got to get the kids breakfast, I've got to have this, I've got to do that, I've got to have my shower, I've got to put my rollers in, I've got to put my makeup on, I've got to, you know, put my clothes on, iron my clothes, go to work, all the things we know we must do, because we don't want to say I'll be late for work, because that means that people aren't going to like us, and we don't like that. But so we lie to ourselves. We're not honest enough. And as long as you don't call the problem by the right name, you'll never see it as a problem. If you really say, I'm too busy, I can't do it, and you believe it's true, then within a day your practice is gone and you'll forget about it. The lamas all say, when you know the benefit of something, and we're talking about to yourself, then you will do it. And that's obvious. We're doing this all the time. And unfortunately, because we are pressured by the pressure of having to get money, having to pay the mortgage, having to buy the food, having to do all the things we do, we don't feel we've got a choice. We feel we must work. That feels an absolute. We don't think we can't afford to be lazy about that because we don't want to be without a home. But the point is this. We think it's an outside pressure, but it's not. It's our own decision because we know the benefit of going to work, even though you don't like it, is you get your pay, which means you get a house, which means you won't be homeless. So we know the benefit of going to work. That's why we always make the effort to go to work, even if we're exhausted, because we know we don't want to get sacked. So we've chosen to do that because we know the benefit. If we forgot that we'd get homeless if we didn't go to work, believe me, we wouldn't go to work because we don't want to do it. We'd rather just do what we want, like a child, you know. So we do prioritize. And we do think we make the choices based on what we think is important, which means we know the benefit of doing it. We don't want the opposite. So that means with a spiritual practice, we've got to think a lot harder about what the benefits are, because it's not evident there's any benefit except the quick feel good about doing a meditation for 5 minutes. You know, that's about the best. And this is part of the problem when we come to what we think a spiritual practice is. You know, we think it's a quick fix kind of feel good thing, like you go to the gym and you feel good when you go. You go for a swim, you feel better. You have a nice meal, it's tasty, you feel better. We think it's an instant thing. But that's not, I mean, it's a bonus if you sit down and meditate and feel good. That's a bonus, but it's not the point. It can't be the point. It's like thinking I go to the gym to feel good. Well, when you first go to the gym, if you haven't been going to the gym, believe me, you won't feel good. You'll actually feel bad. But because you know the benefit of it, you're happy to feel bad and you even know it's a good pain. This is true. We know going to the gym, it takes time over, you know, however many pounds you want to lose, however much muscle tone you want to get. We know it's a slow incremental process. So there's a long-term view, whether it's a year or whatever it might be. So then you track yourself. You don't expect to feel good first day or even second. You know this initial stage, before you get used to it, is enormous effort. You've got to push yourself. And this is the point too. You've got the long-term. You know that. That's good. But then the point is, if, let's say, you're doing your, you know, what are the things, whatever you do at the gym, you know, the weights. And as soon as it starts to hurt, you stop. And then you say to yourself, and you lie to yourself, I just did my push-ups, I just did my weights. But you really didn't, because we know until it starts to hurt, you didn't actually do anything. Until it starts to hurt, which is the point you have to start making effort. Nothing changes. You'll never get good muscle tone if you stop once as soon as you start hurting, because that means you've got to the limit of where you are now and you won't improve. So improving necessarily means you've got to stretch yourself. You've got to do something, and this is the point, comes down to it. This is the biggest one of all underneath the laziness. It's the craving for comfort, the craving to feel good, the craving for our comfort zone. This is what keeps us stuck, you know. And this is one of our deepest attachments, one that's so primordial. We are frantic to feel good. And because in our world, we're so fortunate, You know, we can get the right temperature, the right food, any time we like, just with the flick of a switch. One phone call, one click on the computer, you get your needs fulfilled. It's miraculous. It's phenomenal if you think of it in this way, in terms of virtuous karma. The Buddha would say this is due to incredible virtuous karma in the past. But just, and it's generosity karma, actually, if you think about it. The cause of this is our past generosity. That you can just go click and get what you want, right there. It's phenomenal. Actually, it's sort of like magic almost. So easy to get what we want now. But the trouble is, because we have so much attachment, we pollute it. We poison it. We grasp so easily and so quickly. And because we know we can get it so easily, we therefore don't make an effort and we don't appreciate. So then we become terribly lazy, terribly can't be bothered. Unbelievable, you know. And become our own worst enemy, as my mother would say. So the first one is obvious, can't be bothered. The second one is tricky. It feels like a virtue. It really feels like a virtue. It feels like you're being intelligent and you're making the right choices and doing the most important things. So, okay, if let's take the bigger perspective of, let's say, a spiritual practice and the Buddhist approach of the bigger perspective, which is not just this life but future lives, which is very abstract for our minds. I mean, long-term for us means about a week. Long-term might even mean a year. But long-term meaning future lives, that's just too ridiculous, you know. But this will be the Buddhist view. So the long-term goal of the spiritual practitioner, say, in Buddhism, would be your own, the development of your ultimate potential. Long-term, your own enlightenment. That's your long-term goal. And the Dalai Lama always says, you know, if you're going to, you know, you're going to do what's most beneficial, think of the long-term better than the short-term. The benefit. This is a big one. But let's say, even if it's a reasonable long-term, you know, short, long term. Then you'll shift your priorities. So you'll realize if you do want to do a spiritual practice, you'll think of the benefits. That means I'm going to slowly, as time goes, you can't expect an immediate result. If your body takes time to mold into a different shape, well, hey, baby, your mind takes, ironically, a lot longer. It's kind of strange when it's just thoughts, but they take so much longer to shift our stubborn, deluded minds, you know. So we have a fairly long-term goal of spiritual practice, which is to become more conscious of what I'm doing, to badmouth people less, to not fight with my husband every day, to not scream at the kids every day, to control my body, control my speech, and begin to see my mind. Even if we think short-term, that's short-term, believe me, and it's already incredible. Then we know we've got a reasonable goal, like the gym, you've got to go up for a year before you get a result. Then you know you've got to have at least a year or two to do this to really see some results. So when you have that as your perspective and you know that's the goal, like you visualize yourself in the year with nice toned muscles and less fat, you get excited. It gives you courage. And that's why it's so important to remember the benefits. And the benefit is a nice body. The benefit is money in the bank and a house and not homelessness for working. The benefit of a spiritual practice is you become the person you want to become. And that means, you know, one that doesn't abuse others, which means is a person who's more happy, more content, less fearful, less depressed, less anxious. This we know we want. We know we want this. But our trouble is, it's too painful to do it slowly. We want it now because we're so desperate, you know. So then we hear about meditation. And the commonest idea about meditation is this sort of alternative to a pill. That if you do it, you'll feel better. If you do it, it'll calm your mind. All these cliched ideas. There's some truth in it, but it's like saying when I go to the gym tomorrow, I'll come home looking like perfect. There's a misconception. Of course, in theory, of course, meditation is an amazing technique, knowing to do it properly, combined with various other things, that will in the long term definitely be an excellent tool to help you become a better person. There's no question. But we've got to have some space and time, you know. I remember hearing one person say, she said in a course, well, you know, I tried meditating once and it didn't work. I mean, it's beyond naive, isn't it? So you've got to have long term. You've got to be very rational in thinking of the benefits of a spiritual practice, even a tiny one. You've got to start somewhere. You've got to see the logic of it, the one that you choose to do, not do it frantically and cross your fingers. And then start one baby step at a time with patience and humility, knowing if you're doing the right thing, the right results will come, which means you've got to put up with the miserable, untoned, you know, exhausted person as you gradually mold your body into the shape you want it to be. Or as here, of course, as you gradually mold your mind, as Lama Zofa puts it, into the shape you want it to become. So when we know the benefits, like this, and we have to tell ourselves every day, then we would be sad not to do our practice. You'll feel if you didn't go to the gym, you missed out on something. You'll feel sad. But we have to be our own boss in this way, you know. So that means we then have to prioritize it and give it at least equal status with all the other jobs we feel we must do. So one of the things we feel we must do, which seems an absolute to us, is we must have some sleep. We feel we must have food in our body. We take these as absolutes. So, of course, we prioritize them. So to at least even give equal, we must go to work to get money to pay the mortgage so we don't get homeless. These are fairly reasonable within an ordinary life. So then even if we put this one in there and make it a must, forget it. I mean, ideally, if we're really practicing, we'd make it the top priority. Like the great yogis who don't sleep and don't eat, because they've really developed their spiritual practice and their compassion overrides everything. I mean, this seems way too much for us. But let's give it at least equal status with our ordinary activities. Yeah. Equal status. And see the benefits. Aim for, like, even like, get your spreadsheet, make a plan, do all the things we do. Nothing wrong with that. And then know a little practice to do and stick it into the schedule in the morning. Best, of course, is the first thing you do. Start and end your day on something. You know, it's the best. Perfect. And it doesn't have to be an hour. It can be 10 minutes of getting out of bed, reminding yourself. You know, the typical Buddhist one would be you wake up and you remind yourself you're still alive. I mean, this is like a joke to us. We'll go, well, of course I'm alive. I'm me. But, you know, Buddha would say one of the mistakes we make in our mind is that we instinctively believe everything's permanent. Things will last forever. We assume this. We know perfectly well it's not true, but it's very deep in our bones. So it's like a default we go to. It's an assumption. We've got to alter that. We've got to argue with that. Because the fact is, you do some surveys. We never do this kind of survey. Within a 100-mile radius of here, knock on doors and find out if anybody died last night who didn't expect to. You're going to get quite a percentage who did. But we don't do surveys like that. But that should be very helpful, because that'll be me one day. I know it sounds hilarious, but it's very powerful for the mind as a wake-up call, you know, when you have a priority. You know, when you prioritize something, you do it with a sense of urgency. You've got a flight at 6 o'clock tonight. Suddenly you'll prioritize dramatically the jobs that are important. You won't suddenly start bringing the carpenter in to do the new shelves in the kitchen. You won't suddenly start bringing, you know, doing the carpet cleaning. You suddenly put away the other jobs that aren't important in order to get your flight at 6 o'clock. We understand this. So having a sense of impermanence, a sense of urgency for life, which is a good one, because there's no time to waste. You don't want to waste this precious life that you work so hard to get, the Buddha would say. Then realize, wow, I'm still alive. I woke up this morning. I'm not dead yet. Amazing. Another opportunity to develop myself, help, be a good person, not harm others, grow my own spiritual person. Step by baby step, step by baby step, like your inner gym, you know. So then you're already optimistic. You get out of bed, and then the best thing to do, typical one for the Buddhists, when you do, you have your little altar, we have your things maybe or whatever, to remind you, just a good reminder, that's all. And then you do a little bit of practice, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 7 minutes, doesn't matter, where you take stock. You put yourself down, you're spending 5-7 minutes with just yourself. I think about the only time we're ever on our own is in the toilet. I'm not kidding now. Or in sleep when you're in bed. And even then we're not alone if you've got partners and things. It's rare that we're actually alone. But here we have to learn to be our own therapist, as Lama Yeshe puts it. And I think it's like saying being your own, becoming your own friend. In the morning, not just to get out on default mode and frantic, rush here, rush there, to get the shower, do the thing, scream at this, get our food, anxious, worried, get in the car, anxious, worried. I mean, we're exhausted by the end of the day. Take 5-7 minutes to consciously steady ourselves. Do a little bit of practice. Do a little mantra. Do a little prayer. A little aspiration. Read one sentence of something and think about it. Do meditate on your breath. Control your mind for 5 minutes. And then make some goals for the day. I'm going to be controlling. You know who you're going to see the day. You've got the traffic, the dramas, the mean drivers. You've got the boss. You've got the mean person at work. You're going to watch your body. You're not going to speak bad words. You're going to protect yourself from being neurotic. You're going to protect yourself from harming others. You make a little choice, because that's all spiritual practice. You do your 5 minutes. Then you do the rest of your things. So to say, I'm too busy, I'll do it later. Not only is it laziness, it's a lie. And we believe our own propaganda. That's our problem, because we feel guilty. We're too scared to say to ourselves, I can't be bothered doing it. I don't want to do it now. I can't be bothered. It takes too much effort. Maybe I'll do it later. We don't say that. That's more honest. Or really, I don't see the benefits. That would be the answer. Because that's why we took. That's why. It's simple. That's why we don't do it. I mean, I was a bit. One friend of mine, I was a bit kind of unkind to her. I made her nervous, and you'll see what I mean. She lived about half an hour away from the centre. She's got kids. A busy life. We've all got busy lives, you know. But this is where we can be real contradictory. We say we're practitioners. We say we're practicing a Buddhist. We say we want to do a practice. We feel bad we don't do a practice. I wish I could come to the teachings. I really try to come to the teachings. I can't come to the teachings. But I'm too busy. I've got the kids. I've got this. I've got that. We say like that. And we believe it. And I said to her, if there were a check for $1,000 at the centre for you to pick up, would you make the effort to come? She absolutely didn't hesitate. She was embarrassed, but she said, of course I would. You'd make the time. You put the kids in the car. You say, I've got to get this check for $1,000. And suddenly the time would appear in front of like a bubble. And you'd suddenly find, and this is how our minds are. Hear me. You know what I'm saying. So the logic we have to assume is that we haven't yet seen the benefit of doing a practice. It seems too holy and high, you know. We know we want it when we see our own behavior every day, anxious and worried and depressed and angry. We feel guilty. I must do some practice. I must try and change. But we don't do it. It's like saying every day, I must lose weight. I must go to the gym. But we don't do it because it takes too much effort to get the momentum going. Once the momentum's going, we're on a roll. It's good. It's that initial one that's so painful for us. So we have to think about the benefits. We have to think about the benefits. And we have to be courageous and honest with ourselves. Don't lie to ourselves. It's tough. But we've got to be our own boss, you know. The third one is the worst of all, which assumes all of these. And it comes to the main problem. And it doesn't sound like laziness at all, but you'll hear. It's the one that says, oh, that's just not possible. I couldn't do that. So even when it comes to coming to the teachings, you know, because it seems like impossible. You've got the kids, you've got this, you've got the 30 minutes driving there and back. It's just too, you can't even see that it's possible. It seems impossible. There's one way of seeing it. It seems impossible. I can't do that. Not possible. It's just not true. Like I said about the $1,000 check. Once you know the value of something, then you will make it possible. You will want to do it. That's something easy to think, because we all know the benefit of having extra money. That's instant. That's so obvious. We will do anything. It will even go at 3 a.m. Honestly, any one of us in this room, unless you're mega rich, and even then if we're mega rich, we're still like another $1,000. The only time you could go at 3 a.m, you'd do it. No problem, you'd do it. You'd say, I can do it. I can do it. You'd say that easily. I can do it. And what that is confidence. Optimism. Confidence. An optimism. In other words, you're seeing yourself as the one who's the powerful one, who makes the decisions, and you're not overwhelmed by the power of all the outside things that look so absolute to us that seem to be running our lives. It seems, everything's out there looming large, and it seems everything seems just pressuring me to do something. So we would say, it's impossible. I couldn't do that. But instantly we know we would, when you see the benefits of something. So we have to think. That's all we've got to think. What is the benefit of doing what's called a spiritual practice? Long term. The point of it, Buddhist terms, is to, as Lama Zopa says, to mould your mind into the shape you'd like it to be. And we all know, if we again did another survey, would you like to be kind, loving, patient, courageous, optimistic, generous, forgiving, less angry, less depressed, less jealous? We'd check every single box without any question. Would you rather be angry, jealous, depressed, low self-esteem, have people abuse you, abuse others? We know we would say no. Well, that's the goal of a spiritual practitioner. It's very simple. So we're desperate. That's why we come to places like this. We are desperate to feel better, to feel less miserable, less fearful, to be more, when we think of optimism, when we think of people who are enthusiastic, who have achieved their goals, we just adore people like this. We wish we could be like them. We can be. We can be. That's the one about, it's not possible. I can't do that. The more we reify a person, put them up there. Even if you like, even if you just want to be a cyclist, and you go to the, you know, you see the television, you'll see old Mr. Lance. I know Lance is a naughty man now, Lance Armstrong. But still, he was the example of an amazing cyclist. You'd all the yearnings when you're younger. Yearnings to be this, to be that, to be this, to be that. You don't want to do something. You yearn, you have these ideals, you have the goals, you have your Serena Williams on the wall, you have your Lance Armstrong, or whatever it is you want to be, you know. And you live in this world of wanting to be this. We live in this, there's this disconnect between in here, the fantasy, the ideal, we see the thing out there, and it looks so appealing, so tasty. You want to lose weight, and you see the people all toned in the quickest losing weight ones with their lovely muscles, and they go on little cute little things, and they run, and all this, and the lovely food, and you go, oh, I'd love to be like that. And then we look at the status quo, and we go, not possible. You understand? Not possible. Because, and when we look at not possible is attachment to comfort, the sloth of can't be bothered, too much effort, and it's all down to I can't do it, it's impossible. Because and that comes to grasping at the status quo, believing that this is the status quo, this is who I am, it can't change, it's not possible. It seems too high, because we don't see it as an incremental, gradual, impermanent, slow, organic process. We see the end result, and we see me, and we can't see the space in between. That means grasping at things as permanent, me, the status quo, can't be bothered, attachment to comfort, which overrides all the fantasies. So we have this terrible disconnect in our lives, the dissatisfaction is all the regrets of the things we didn't achieve. You know what? I quote this a bit these days, reading about one Australian nurse in England who wrote a book called The Five, she worked with dying people, The Five Greatest Regrets of the Dying. And the greatest regret, not doing what I really wanted to do, not doing what was in my heart, but doing what I thought other people expected of me. And that's another dimension to it. The same problem is there. But the other dimension, this is another one, another problem added to it, which is the attachment to what people think, which is many of the reasons that one of the main reasons why it holds us back from doing what we really want to do. But this is an added dimension to the laziness one, which just makes it worse, you know. First of all, can't believe it's possible. I can't do that. But they're not believing it's possible because I shouldn't do that. They wouldn't approve. I'm not allowed to do that. Oh, no, I wouldn't be able to do that. There's an extra one that makes it even worse, you know. So the more we give power to the outside, the more we have fear of the outside and all that looks so big, you know, like impossible, and you feel pressured by it, I've got to go to work and it's not fair, and you're angry every day and upset every day and I wish I didn't have to work, truly believing you're working because other people think you should because you've got no choice about it. So we feel impotent, we feel hopeless, we don't feel like running our lives at all, you know. So we have to learn to run our own lives. We are the boss. We are the boss. We have to be the boss. So becoming our own friend, having courage, knowing it's logical, you can accomplish that goal. You just got to start one day at a time. They say all these wonderful things our mother used to say. Rome was not built in a day. They're also logical. So this is the point about the opposite to the laziness. It's enthusiasm. They call it, one of the qualities you get is enthusiasm. Now we know enthusiasm is optimism, and optimism and enthusiasm sound like I can do it. That's what optimism is. That's what enthusiasm is. I can do it. And when you say you can do it, you will do it. It somehow seems possible. When you're despairing and depressed and hopeless and can't do it and too much effort, it's not possible. Nothing looks possible. You become paralyzed with fear and hopelessness and low self-esteem, you know. But it's logical. We can do it. We can do it. We're not turning into a Buddha overnight. We're not turning into a perfect, beautifully behaved, you know, calm person overnight. But we have to start somewhere. So we don't lie and say, I'm too busy. We don't lie and say, I can't do it. And we go against the inertia of the comfort zone And we start humble and small with something. And then you build it up every day. And that's the thing. When you think of, if you think of spiritual practice as the reason is to feel better, well, then you won't even try. Don't have that as your goal. Think of it as slowly, gradually molding your mind, like molding your body into a new shape. And it just takes time. In other words, it's not evident to you at that first day in the gym. No one would know by looking at you that you just spent a day at the gym. No one can tell that you didn't and that anything's changed. But you've started the ball rolling. So we have to have humility and patience and discipline. I can do it. Know the benefits. And just begin. And don't put it off. This is our worst crime. Our worst crime. So to end our days, this is the thing about putting things off. We live with all the fantasies of what we'd like to do if only we could do. And we fantasize doing it. And then the inertia of not doing it and putting it off and can't be bothered. And the self-loathing that comes from this, the stress that comes from this is much worse than any stress from doing it. So start small. Something in the morning. And then you finish your day with something. You take stock of the day. And, you know, we do these little purification practices. You visualize certain things, say certain mantra, regret certain things, make determination not to do it again. And then, as Lamayashi says, go to bed with a happy mind. One day at a time. One day at a time. Anyone can do it. You just have to decide. And that means suddenly the space will appear and you'll put it in there when you prioritize it. When you prioritize it. What do you think? Anybody disagree with me? What do you think? Disagree with me? Agree with me? Everyone agrees with me, I think. I'm going to have some water. Excuse me. It's a very deep habit. You know, I see in my own life, I mean, people think I'm not lazy, you know, because I look busy and move around and look like I'm doing something all the time. But it's just not true, I promise you. I can see in my own mind, you know, my work, my job, since I've become a nun, I'm not only am a nun, but I also, my job is I work for my lamas are also my bosses, you know, they're my bosses. So I've worked for them all my life. That means, if you think of Dharma things, if you think in terms of the Dharma and the meaning of Dharma and doing Dharma work, blah, 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 you know, then you feel, oh, that's great, some quality to the work I'm doing, it's useful, it's helping sentient beings in one way or another, which is true, technically, my jobs, you know. But I tell you, I put things off all the time. All the jobs have equal status for me in their being Dharma jobs. But I see my mind, and it happens in like a millisecond. You don't have this long conversation with yourself and then struggle and go against the wish to not do that job. You just, in a millisecond, you've moved from that thing on your computer to the thing you want to do. You know, because the thing we want to do is the thing that looks good. You go towards it. You're attracted to doing it. It's the one that's easier for you, that you know how to do, that's easier for you. And the one you don't want to do is less easy for whatever reason. So you put it away. You know, you put it in the too hard basket. You leave it there. You do it all the time. I can only imagine if I never put anything off that you do have to do, you'd feel so much better. You'd feel more poignant, more perky and happy. And you'd accomplish so many more things. And you wouldn't feel stressed. Because the stress is the stress between the conflict between all the shoulds and the woulds and the if onlys and the can'ts and I don't want to. But that's why we have got to sort our own mind out and be more sincere with ourselves. And then when we do prioritize our jobs, which we have to do, then even though it will take longer, those things there, you don't feel guilty about it, you know. Sometimes with Lama Zopa, they told me when we did one of Lama Zopa's books, edited one of his books called Dear Lama Zopa, and it's all about his letters that he gets from his students all over the world, lots of people. And as Holly, the Australian nun who does all his letters and stuff, she says there's this folder that they give to Rinpoche every night that has up to, you know, sometimes can be hundreds of letters from various people. So Rinpoche will check the ones, usually the priorities are like the health things and urgent things like this, you know. So he'll take one of those, and then even though he's got 200 letters to write, he said he takes every letter unbelievably seriously. He might spend 7 hours on one person's little request, you know. He gives absolute maximum to everyone. And then what happens is, you might wait, and I've heard recently for some people recently, friends of mine, you wait 2 years, you'll get a reply. You'll get a reply eventually. That's normal. In the world, you couldn't, you'd be too ashamed to do this. You'd feel guilty. You'd either throw it away and not do it, or you'd send it back. Or you feel overwhelmed by the stress, you know, because you couldn't handle all these requests. You go mad, you know. But someone with Rinpoche, okay, whatever reason, whatever his mind is, not like that. So he doesn't feel stressed by it. He doesn't put things off. He's got masses of jobs on his lists, and he does them eventually. And very often, I mean, two people I think of now who got their letter 2 years later, they said it was the perfect timing anyway. Even one friend had some cancer in the brain. She took 2 years to get her answer. It was the right time. It was very phenomenal, you know. I'm just talking, you know, just chatting away here. But I'm lazy. I can see my mind so lazy. Of course, it's all relative between all of us. It's relative. And the thing is, this is where, again, the biggest problem we have is as soon as we point out our mistakes, our default mode is in guilt. So we assume that guilt, which is beating yourself up, which is self-hate, basically, we assume that's the only conclusion to come to if you didn't do your jobs properly. So this is also that causes so much pressure and stress in our minds. But that isn't the valid response. It's completely the wrong response. We have to practice a new response. So it's like as soon as we say, oh, I didn't do my job properly, we assume it's right to say, I'm therefore a bad person. That's the default mode for us now. That's just exactly like if you see someone out there do something wrong, you immediately say, they're a bad person. We never think you can not say that conclusion. That conclusion seems an absolute truth to us. Look at that terrible people out there dropping those bombs. They are evil. Look at that wretched person raping somebody. He is evil. We get angry. We get angry. Anger is this concrete, over-exaggerated assessment of something, and you define the whole person by it. Of course raping is wrong. Of course war is wrong. Of course putting off isn't cool. But the conclusion, I'm bad or you're bad, that's called anger or guilt or self-hate, that's just ego. It's not helpful. It isn't helpful. It's more subtle. It has to be more precise, more clear than that. So it's like when we do the regret and the purification practice. The first step is to regret the bad things I've done, to regret the killing, the lying, the harming. It's too hard for us because we assume I have to feel I'm therefore a bad person. But I always quote this, but His Holiness was asked one time, what's the difference between guilt and this particular point here called regret? It's very precise, but you have to practice it. He said guilt, like I said before, is you look in the past and you go, I did this and I did that and I did this, and then you go, I'm a bad person. And we assume that's just the truth. We never unpack that. We never question it. And that's the point. He said, no, regret is different. You go, you got to go, yes, I did do this. Yes, I did do that. Yes, I did do this. Yes, I killed somebody, lied, put off my jobs, was lazy, whatever. You state it. If it's a truth. But you don't go, oh, therefore I'm a bad person. You go, what can I do to change? That's the miracle. That's where everything changes. That's optimism, that's humility, that's reasonableness, that's intelligence, that's wisdom, it's perfect. Just like Martin Luther King said, it's good to see fault out there. You must see it, you must see injustice. But, you know, you just don't scream and rant and rave, which is what guilt is here or anger out there, which is impotent, which doesn't help anything. You go, what can I do to help? That's amazing. This sounds so tiny, but it's miraculous. So we have to see the problems. You go to the gym, you have to know which muscle group to work on, which ones aren't working. Well, you know, the trainer comes along, well, those muscles aren't so good. You don't go kill yourself, oh, I'm a bad person, and hate yourself because you didn't work on the right muscles. You're excited and happy he's told you what to do. Oh, okay, I better fix that. What can I do about it? Which weights will I carry? Whatever you say about weights. Lift. So we've got to learn to go against the instinct of ego, which is to leap into misery and self-pity and guilt. And it is self-pity. But it's the natural instinct of ego to over-exaggerate. Anger over-exaggerates the badness. It is already bad. to have war. But then anger on top of it just makes it all worse. It doesn't help. And that's a big surprise to us because we assume anger is a natural response to seeing injustice, like guilt is a natural response to seeing fault. Completely mistaken. It's just wrong. You've got to see problems out there. How can you practice compassion otherwise? You've got to see faults here. How can you grow otherwise? It's impossible. That's why it's so much more torturing for us to do spiritual practice. We don't have a mental breakdown, like I'm saying, when your piano teacher tells you you're playing the piano wrong. You're happy that they told you. Unless you're very stubborn and very proud and very, you know, depressed, concrete in other words. So we have to see our faults. But the reason you see your faults is so that you can change them and so you can become the person you want to become. It's very necessary to see fault. But we're so heavy when we use the word fault or bad person or morality. It's so caught up in this moralistic kind of model of blame and shame and guilt and evil and punishment and reward. This dualistic one which is very strong inside us. Have to change that one. Absolutely have to change that view. Then from this comes optimism. From this comes reasonableness and courage and optimism and humility. All in the context of knowing my potential, knowing where I'm heading, knowing the person I want to become. Therefore, I have to see what is causing the obstacle to my becoming it. Then I have to address the obstacle. It's reasonable. It's like practicing to become a pianist or anything else. So important. We have to become our own best friend, you know. We can't do it. We have to have some time with ourselves. It seems boring for us. We come, just being on your own sounds like loneliness. We don't want to know about it. It sounds weird. It sounds like a punishment. But when we start doing this, start becoming our own friend, start becoming our own therapist, start really listening to ourselves and being accountable to ourselves. Not being completely caught up 24 hours a day in trying to make others happy, which means getting their approval. Don't hear that in the wrong way. Wanting to make others happy is sublime. That's the compassion wing. That's the most advanced. But the craving we have to get the nice response from somebody is not to make them happy. That's attachment to them saying I'm a good person because I don't think I am. So I'm desperate for them to say I am. And so we live for that. We live for that response. This is our main attachment. Our main attachment, the deepest, most primordial. It's so hard to see this. It's every second in our mind all the time. We're thinking about they this and they that, and if I did this and they that, and I'm thinking this and she this and that. We don't even notice it. It's so strong, so concrete, so deep inside us. We have to learn to be our own person, be our own therapist, be our own friend, be accountable to ourselves, knowing we have to do the work. Make our choices. Be accountable. Don't need other people's approval. This is huge. Sounds massive to us. So it's not only the laziness, but this added one of attachment to what other people think of us. They're the ones that hold us paralyzed. We can do it. One humble step at a time. Long-term patience. What does Holiness says? Bodhisattvas think in terms of eons. You know, the Buddha says your mind will never end. Your mind will never end. So we must start somewhere. Well, as Lama Zogu puts it, how come the Dalai Lama is where he's at now? We've both got beginningless minds and both got endless minds. And there's the Dalai Lama, he's a Buddha, and he's me as a peanut. Well, the difference is he made effort, that's all. Not, oh, that's just the Dalai Lama and I can't do it. No, not like that. Not like that. So that should be giving me enthusiasm. He was a regular guy once. That's what I find so powerful about the Buddha. We're not used to thinking this way because we're so used to thinking religion is God, creator, perfection always. Buddha was a regular guy, an ordinary person, who then became an enlightened person, who removed all the delusions from his mind and perfected all these things, which he is then laying out and has been laid out since as all his methods, you know. So that should give great courage rather than, oh, it's not possible, because we assume karma, reincarnation, clairvoyance, all these qualities, that it's impossible. But if one person called Mr. Buddha, who was regular, did it, that proves, logically, I can do it. I'm a normal human being too. It's logical that I can do it. But what we do is we reify the Buddha. We reify the Dalai Lama. Oh, he's a Buddha. That's just how he is, you know. No, I can't do that. It's just not true. It's actually not true. It's a delusion. And it's a laziness. It gets us off the hook, you know. We'd rather have someone up there to praise and think it's gorgeous and save me, you know. Have to do it myself. No choice. Have to do it. No choice. One step at a time. Have confidence. Have humility. Have patience. Make effort. Little tiny bit at a time. Long-term goal. And that means discipline. And it means, and I see it in my own mind, every day you've got to go against the, because the instinct, the impulse of attachment for comfort is so profound. It's just like we sink into the inertia, you know. Because we can be comfortable so easily. We just go like a magnet. The comfort, the right temperature, the right feeling of the clothes, the right food. And we can get it so easily. So it's so easy to stay in that attachment to comfort, you know. But we know, this is the kind of irony of it. Attachment, even just use a simple example of the chocolate cake, you know. Attachment, feeling needy inside. Attachment is a disease of feeling dissatisfied. That's its energy, not being enough, not having enough, which means always finding fault, always feeling distressed. It's just the way it is. It's the nature of attachment, people. But we say, therefore, I'm doing something wrong. We turn it into a weapon, a knife that stabs ourselves. It's just the nature of attachment, dissatisfaction. So then you think of, so the obvious one is the food. It's a very obvious one. The object of the senses, you know. Whichever the one is that turns us on. So then you see the cake. It looks delicious. And you really, and the attachment's kind of frantic. And the hand goes out, can't resist, you know. Puts it in the mouth. Because why? Because you're anticipating the satisfaction. So actually what we're doing is we're increasing the suffering. Because you're going to, as my mother used to say, the more you get, the more you want. We kind of know it, but we're too scared to go against it. But the point is this. It does take effort to not put the cake in the mouth. That's huge effort. And like terror. You know, isn't it? Attachment, not getting what it wants, is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Terrifying. This is, the fear of attachment is immense. When the attachment is very strong to get its object, it's like as if you're going to die if you don't get it. So it's horrifying. The sense of loss of not having it. So this is, we give in every time. So the point I'm getting at. As soon as we make the effort, mental effort, to not put the cake in the mouth, let's say, if that's our decision, then we didn't taste the cake. But what we've just begun to taste is our own potential. And that's the real pleasure. That's the real satisfaction. That's what satisfaction is. That's what happiness finally is you becoming the boss, you becoming powerful, you not succumbing to the pressures about the outside world, you know, you tasting your own potential. That is what happiness is. And we know you go to the gym, you didn't want to, you make an effort, you go, you come back home, you feel great. Mostly, you feel good about yourself. Mostly you feel good about yourself because you did it. You're happy. You felt glad. You went against the laziness. That's what gives enthusiasm. That's what brings joy. That's what brings happiness because you're tasting yourself, not just a cake. That's Dharma practice. Every single day. And then slowly, slowly, the results will come. It's a fact. We have to be brave and honest with ourselves, you know. Time to go home. A bit late, 10 minutes late. I'm very sorry, I forgot. Okay. Well, we'll think about that, won't we? Take it home. Food for thought. Okay, make an effort. Don't give up on yourself, please. The worst crime against ourselves is to give up on ourselves, you know. Prioritize. 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 Because you can't be helpful to others until we've done this. So it's for the sake of others as well. Think this way. And we dedicate these few thoughts, these ideas. May we never give up. Become this marvelous person. We can become. One step at a time. Do you sing prayers now?
Yes, son. If you go to the first pink sheet in the white prayer book, in the meantime, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Venerable Katie Cole, her dedication, may we not arise heresy even for 1 second, and the actions of the glorious guru, with faith and respect gained from seeing their goodness, may full inspiration flow into our hearts. Ken and Annie Hassel, no dedication, anonymous. May all teachers of pure Dharma have long lives. May all caregivers of people with Alzheimer's find peace and comfort. And Paul Hagwood. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind down by perfection. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savor the snow land teachings and transmigratory beings who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion. To the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjana's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.